Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larson, Judge Cochran, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Elise Larson presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning, counsel. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. For the audio record, today is March 26th, 2025. Today's argument is being live streamed, and we are also making an audio recording. An audio recording of today's hearing will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. A reminder to those who are here today that no other recordings are permitted without the express permission of the Court of Appeals. With that, we have three cases on our oral argument calendar this morning. Our first case is case number A24-1605, Larry Koch v. Riley Purgatory Bluff Creek Watershed District. Good morning, counsel. As I'm sure you're both aware, you will each be given 15 minutes for your argument this morning, and appellants, you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Before beginning your argument, please feel free to take the time to adjust the podium to your comfort. And because we're only making an audio record, if you would please identify yourself and your client before beginning your argument, we would appreciate it. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
May it please the court, my name is John Hayden on behalf of appellant Larry Koch. This appeal asks the court to serve its essential role as a check on the actions of an unappointed legislative body. Mr. Koch's claims seek to hold that body accountable to the law. Yet rather than addressing the merits, the trial court imposed a surety bond that functioned as a de facto dismissal without any ruling on the underlying issues. That bond prolonged the litigation and distorted the process. The bond was brought at the same time as a motion to dismiss, which could have been ruled on in 90 days. Instead, we kicked out, we had extra briefing on the bond. We got a ruling 261 days after the motions were brought. And in that entire time, the appellant's substantive arguments were not addressed. The hearing on the renewed surety bond request and the motion to dismiss initially was canceled. There was no oral argument below. And then despite significant changes to financing after the motion was brought, the court solicited more briefing without oral argument, further kicking it out. So rather acting as a constitutional safeguard, the court below became an enabler, sidestepping the merits and effectively shielding the district from the legal scrutiny. That is an abuse of discretion that runs through every issue in this case, and there are four issues. The first issue was the improper dismissal of the open meeting law and data practice claims, along with those related to the surety bond and the alleged harms that arose from that. The second was the improper application of a surety bond statute to the new financing scheme, which is a contract for deed and not a bond, in a project was not a public improvement. Next, we believe that the bond amount was excessive and based on improper speculative calculations of interest. And last, the court below failed to analyze the likelihood of success on the issues as required under the surety bond statute. So first, the improper dismissal of open meeting law and data practice claims. The district court dismissed all claims, including those under the aforementioned statutes, despite no finding that these claims pose any risk to the public as far as financial harm. The statute applies only if a claim questions the validity of any action taken or proposed to be taken in the course of the authorization, sale, or issuance of delivery bonds. In order dismissing, this is from Anderson v. Pearson, an order dismissing the action with prejudice for failing to file the bond must be limited to those causes of action that the evidence has shown will affect the public or the taxpayers.
So with regard to that, the plain language of the statute says if a party such surety bond is not filed within a reasonable time allowed thereof by the court, the action shall be dismissed with prejudice. So it says the action. It doesn't say portions of the action or only those that could affect taxpayers. It says the action. So help us understand how your interpretation is consistent with the plain language of the statute.
So respondents raised the definition given in statute for action and take it to mean proceeding and collectively the whole thing. However, in the definition section, the 645.45, the following words and phrases, when used in any law enacted after the effective date, unless the context clearly indicates otherwise, shall have the meanings ascribed to them in this section. So the context is the public harm and the actions. Now, actions are causes of action, and that's when we quote the Anderson v. Pearson. It breaks it down by causes of action.
But that case involves some private causes of action that were only against private parties, such as negligent performance and non-performance of services by Allison Williams and Arthur Chapman and Mickelson. So that didn't involve the public interest at all. Whereas Government Data Practices Act claims and Open Meeting Act claims, those are claims that involve the public interest. So that's where I'm struggling kind of to understand why you think Anderson supports your view, because I think you'd agree that the Open Meetings Law Act is designed to protect the public.
Mm-hmm. The public interest under the surety bond statute to be protected is the harm they could face. And the harm in this case was measured by financial impact.
But Anderson talks about actions that the evidence has shown will affect the public, and an open meeting law action affects the public.
Right, it affects the public, but not in the harm that is protected from the 562.02.
Where does the language of the statute tie that all together, in your view?
Well, the tying together is the I'm just reading the statute real quick. If the public body is not a party to the action, but it deems that such action be injurious to the public interest and to the taxpayer, such public body may intervene. There's no injury in the data practice laws or the open meeting law requirement. In fact, the remedy would not undo the underlying action, but it would hold to account the public body in providing records. So the injury is not to the public in because they're not stopping any of the underlying bond issues or the reasons for the surety bond. So the result of this is the larger the issue, the larger the potential harm, the less likely you'd be able to bring an open meeting law or a data practice violation along with your suit, which is a bit of an absurd result.
The watershed district wouldn't be able to request a surety bond for if this complaint only had an open meeting law claim or only had a Data Practices Act claim. The watershed district wouldn't be entitled to a bond for those kind of claims because they wouldn't be able to prove that there's some kind of financial injury to the taxpayers or to the public from a citizen trying to hold the watershed district accountable for following the processes that are required under the law.
Right.
Correct.
Correct. Yes, that's our position.
Do you have any other questions on that? I'd like to ask you some questions about the arguments that you made in front of the district court. Here you're raising the argument about that this is not this is no longer eligible for the surety bond requirement because they've changed the financing. But when I was looking back at your arguments, it appears that the argument that you made in front of the district court was that we look at the language of the complaint, not to what's happened subsequent to the complaint. And so can you address for me, what when is the time that you, when the district court is issuing a bond, do we look at what's been alleged in the complaint, or do we look at this time that has passed in assessing whether a surety bond is a requirement? Because it seems like there's some potential to create some really strange gray area here, especially in the context of bonding, which, as we know, you know, time will cause things to change in these kinds of litigation. So can you help me understand sort of the what is the point in time that the district court was required to look at?
Well, the district court is allowed to adjust the surety bond, right? So the law does kind of anticipate that there could be changing circumstances, right? And when we brought this suit, it was about bridge financing to get to Hennepin County bonding. So that was the focus of the complaint. They brought their surety bond request at that point. It was denied. They brought it again without any change of underlying circumstance. Same situation. After they brought it, they secured a contract for. Now, that's a materially different. And at that point, we actually did.
But did you amend your complaint?
We did not amend the complaint.
So don't we focus on the action in determining whether there's authority to issue the bond? I mean, going back to your prior, the questions that you and I just were discussing, you know, you're talking about we have to focus on the action that is within the scope of the statute. So if you didn't amend your complaint, how did the district court err in granting the bond or abuse its discretion?
We did bring, we requested to bring a TRO to address the new financing scheme that we found out relatively on short notice. So we brought another TRO, and that was fashioned as a motion to reconsider our initial TRO, and we were not granted leave for that, which led to an appeal. But we did not amend. And the facts, you know, evolving, we feel that you submit your complaint, the underlying facts change, and you can adjust your case accordingly. And now this would allow for this kind of maneuver where you get to start out with a public financing. And then once that's stopped, because essentially once you bring litigation, that confounds that, right? And then you get to move to an extremely expensive, increasing your harms and new kinds of damages to the public that were not foreseen in the original complaint. Your initial calculation of damages had nothing to do with interest, but now your new calculation of damages is all about this new interest. Now, the reason that's important is there was no requirement for them to go out and do this contract for deed. There is no evidence that that land was under any threat of being sold. There's no evidence that the land was in jeopardy in any way, environmentally. They went out and made this decision and created harm, where if they wouldn't have done anything, that land would have been preserved. They wouldn't be. We would have saved them money, because they would not be currently paying interest on something. The land would have been right where we left it, and they could have picked the financing up at the end with lower rates.
I'm rusty on this, but I mean, my recollection on the issue of bonding is that there are separate and different harms that happen from bonded money having to be held because the bonds have been queered, and that there's the calculation of harm might be different, but it's not. It's not that money then, you know, just sits in the coffers. Once the money has been bonded, then it's earmarked for something, and they can't use the money. So there is still harm to the public in terms of that money not accruing interest, right? I mean, at least that's my recollection.
That would be accurate if they had actually secured the bonds. There was no bonds. They tried to get some from Huntington Bank after Hennepin County also never promised to deliver on the financing. The underlying case goes to the rush and hurriedness of this to get this done when no plans were set. No bonds were actually issued. So when we came in, and which stifled their financing with Huntington, right? But there was no new damage, no threat of any damage. They could have just waited and not gone into a contract for deed. And still, there's no evidence that there were any buyers. In fact, there's a strong case to be made that there couldn't be buyers, because anyone interested in that land would know that there's ongoing litigation and that Now the watershed district had this strong interest in preserving it with permitting, so the development dreams were gone as well. The appetite for this land was gone. This opportunity wasn't going to leave them, but they jumped headfirst into a high-interest contract for deed. That's not bonding. They've never done bonding. They've never been secured bonding.
So did you make the argument that you're making here that there isn't authority to issue a bond in a contract for deed situation? Did you make that argument to the district court?
In the supplemental briefing, we emphasized to the court that this is not what they had set out to do in the original complaint. This was a choice that they made to impose.
But did you specifically argue that the district court didn't have the authority because they entered into a contract for deed?
We did not specifically argue that it had escaped that, that, as you said, we did not specifically argue. We raised it in the context of this is a brand new scheme, a new financing scheme that was entirely self-imposed and unnecessary. So what they did is create public harm in order to revive their surety bond, which the court took. Now, I want to, since we talked about that issue, I want to talk also about interest in general as harm. If allowed to stand, the district court's approach would create a perverse incentive. Municipalities would inflate potential public harms by selecting riskier, more expensive financing methods to silence legal challenges. Here, the district pivoted from bond financing to a very costly contract for deed. As I said, that was unnecessary. So speculative harm is not enough. A statute permits a bond only if loss or damage may result from the pending litigation. The language demands real imminent risk, not theoretical projections or avoidable cost. The district claimed harms assumed it will remain in the contract for deed until 2027, which we know it can refinance and rates are going down. And in the Otter Tail case, litigation was delayed the bonding for nearly 3 years. The litigation suspended any possibility of securing bids on bonds for that time. Still, the court rejected the municipality's attempt to recover the high interest costs, even though the village ultimately prevailed. And it did an analysis of, well, interest rates change. We don't know what the refinancing would have looked like. This is all speculative. In our case, we had a bridge financing. We could never anticipate what the Hennepin County rates are going to be. We know rates are coming down everywhere. And we also know that when it refinances, we can't run the amount of damages between the interest from their bridge financing, which was going to last 9 months, through all the way through 2027 as a mass difference that we get charged as potential harm that could not happen. That's too speculative. The Otter Tail.
Yeah, thank you, counsel. I think we understand the speculative. Your time has expired, but you will have 5 minutes
thank
for
you.
Your rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Reavers. I represent the respondents, the Riley Purgatory Bluff Creek Watershed District and its administrator, Terrence Jeffrey. We ask this court to affirm the district court's determination to require a surety bond under Minnesota Statute 562.02 and a subsequent dismissal of this action for failure to post that bond in the reasonable amount of time. Counsel has kind of ticked off four items. I think I'll take them in order. You know, the first one is the action. You know, that the open meeting law and the data request claims were not subject to the surety bond.
Counsel,
and,
can I interrupt before
sure.
you do that? I'll go back to the other issue,
sure.
perhaps that we're more close to what appellant left off with. It does strike me I'll just ask you more directly. There's no reference to contract for deed in the statute, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, and we're doing a lot of intense, the district court did too, reading of the statute. It strikes me that the policy is a bit different when you're doing a contract for deed where you have installments versus a project where you might have a big outlay and potential delay of the project or loss of the project. It seems like none of those factors are present in this particular scenario. Am I wrong?
Respectfully, I would suggest you are, Your Honor, in the sense of the statute applies here. And the fact that there was a contract for deed doesn't take it outside the scope. The action, the operative pleading, the plaintiff, you know, the complaint that we have challenges the not only the our ability to do bonding for the project, it also challenges the actual acquisition of the property too. So we'd suggest the statute applies for two reasons. You know, one for the challenge to the bonding that the district was attempting to do, and number two, that this was the, you know, it also requires the making of a contract for a public improvement. So there's
how
two.
How is the purchase of land a public improvement?
I suggest, Your Honor, that a conservation project, that's the whole underlying purpose of watershed districts, is to maintain and protect the environment. And this is actually, as we pointed out, part of our capital improvement plan for the district. And, excuse me, Your Honor, and so we pointed to the watershed district statute is because the statute doesn't define 56202, doesn't define public improvement within that section. But if we look to the watershed district provisions, 13, and we've cited these in our memo, Minnesota statute, give me a second, 103D, 0.011, subdivision 21, and really looking at what a project means in terms of a watershed district, you know, from, and that is.
Do we have any law that says that when interpreting what a project is for the purpose of a public, and I wasn't able to find any, but in terms of determining what a project is for the purpose of the surety bond requirement, do we have any case law that would indicate that you look to sort of the purpose of the agency that's doing the project to evaluate? Like, I'm trying to draw the line. I'm trying to draw the line for why we can look at 103D to determine what project means for the purpose of the watershed district, as opposed to what a project might mean for the highway department or right. Some other agency.
I just think it's different from a watershed district's not building bridges and roads. They're protecting the environment and water quality, and that's the whole idea here: is the protection of the environment and water quality. You know, we call it a concept. It's clearly a project within the, as defined by the watershed district.
And council, doesn't that difference though precisely get into the issue of whether a bond is necessary to protect the district from vexatious or because it's just going to sit there and continue to be what it was in its entire history until the litigation is done, whereas the building project. It would be stalled, and so you post the bond and to cover the cost to the public of the delay. But here, I'm trying to understand what the cost to the public of the delay would be when there's really no risk of letting the litigation run its course because it's going to sit the way it is today, tomorrow, and to the end of the year.
And we don't know that, Your Honor. And I think the district court squarely addressed that in its order. This is on page 7 and 8 of the district court's order, and the district court specifically said the court finds that the district's decision to enter into the contract for deed mitigated the greater potential harm to the taxpayers and the public of losing the opportunity to purchase the property. So the district made the legislative determination, we don't want to lose this opportunity, and the district court made a finding.
But isn't it true, as Appellant pointed out, what's the risk here because the district would have as the permitting authority and it's already apparently because the litigation scared off developers from it. So what's the real risk that needs to be mitigated?
They could lose, they were concerned about losing the opportunity to purchase the property.
Is there any evidence to indicate that there's anything that would prevent the owner of the land from selling the land to somebody else?
That's exactly it. I mean, there was no restriction, and that's why the district moved to, you know, we couldn't do bonding because of the lawsuit, and we've got the affidavit or the declarations of bond counsel that you can't get bonding while there's litigation pending. We can't do it on appeal, even though the case was dismissed for failure to post the bond. We're still in the same predicament as in this case could continue to go on and on. I mean, this court, we asked the court to, expedite the appeal and recognize that the court has a busy calendar and denied our request. But the longer this litigation continues, the greater the harm to the taxpayer because the interest continues to accrue. And we've laid that out in our supplemental brief, which the district court basically folded most of that analysis in. And so we're trying to get to the finish line. We can't get bonding until this case is done, this action is completely dismissed, including this appeal and any potential appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court. Appellate practice takes time, as this court's aware. My experience, it's pretty much a year at each level. A year here, if case goes to the Supreme Court and they accept review. The last one I had, they took over a year to issue a decision on the park dedication case we had in front of them. So an appellate case can take a couple years, and that's our concern. And that's why we tried to lay out in detail for the court. That's why we did the contract for deed out to 29 to give us, because we don't know what's going to happen with the litigation. We want to make sure we build in sufficient time for this thing to run its course, and then we can move forward on the bonding through Hennepin County. But nobody is going to, Hennepin County, Huntington Bank, no one will issue a bond while there's pending litigation. And so we do ask the court to the extent necessary to expedite, to the extent you can, decision on this so that we can mitigate the harm to the taxpayers here too.
I do have some questions on this issue of sort of the remaining non-bonding related claims. At least it appears to me from our case law and the Supreme Court's case law that we maybe see our syllabus points a bit differently than you argued in your brief in terms of the weight of the precedential authority that they might have. The Supreme Court has certainly cited its own syllabus and indicated that to the extent the court is the one writing the syllabus that you can cite, you can reference the syllabus, and I think that we have a series of cases where we've decided the same thing. And so why isn't the appropriate remedy here to remand to the district court for it to evaluate whether under Anderson any of appellant's claims survive the failure to pay the surety bond?
In your honor, I think we look no further than the plain language of the statute. I mean, the statute uses
you don't disagree that we're bound. I mean, this panel are bound by our prior precedential decisions, which would indicate that action might mean something different in the context of the surety bond than the definition in 645.
Well, I recognize the court is certainly bound by precedent, but what I would suggest is there's a difference between if there were private actions. I read Anderson, it's really a different the private action versus the public here, and these are claims.
But going to that point, and I understand your argument in that regard, and Anderson is a little bit of a different case because there was at least one count that I think was purely private against the Allison Williams and Arthur Chapman. But the statute does say, I mean, it talks about an action questioning directly or indirectly the existence of a condition or anything precedent to or the validity of any action taken or proposed to be taken by any public body or its officers or agents in the course of the authorization or sale, issuance, or delivery of bonds, and then it goes on. But it doesn't include the open meeting law or the Government Data Practices Act. So the type of action that is the focus of this statute is an action questioning the validity of the issuance, sale, or delivery of bonds as it relates to this case. So it seems to me appellants do have a point with regard to the term action as used in this statute, that it's not, that it's limited by the language of the statute, and therefore the Data Practices Act and open meetings law wouldn't be within the scope of the action as defined by this statute. Can you respond?
And here's the dilemma. I mean, I think just from a practical standpoint, if we're carving this out, the litigation, we could get that part dismissed and we're still not able, the litigation is still pending And so we're still in the same dilemma that we are, that, wait, the court issues a limited surety, only dismisses these claims.
Well, all that would be left would be the open meeting law and Data Practices Act claims, which would have nothing to do with the bonding.
But the case would be final. And so the problem is, and we've got the affidavit or the declaration from bond counsel, once the litigation is not final until all appeals are exhausted.
So your position is that if this case had been brought just as an open meeting law claim and a Data Practices Act claim, that would queer the bonding?
I'm sorry.
That if all appellant had done was brought a, this procedure violated the open meeting law, the procedure of the watershed district had violated the open meeting law, and the watershed district has violated the Data Practices Act because they aren't responding or whatever violation, that would also make it so you couldn't get the bonding.
Well,
if that was purely the complaint, right? Because that's the problem with the interpretation that you're proposing, is that you can have a complaint that has claims that definitely would make it impossible to get bonding, and then you can have claims that really don't have anything to do with the purchase of the property, have to do with whether you got the process that was due to you. And, you know, I do think that interpreting action so broadly in this might, you know, make it so that it's impossible to get claims that if they were brought separately or individually would not have been, no bond would have been required for those claims.
Well, and the appellants chose how to plead this case. You know, they weren't required to throw the kitchen sink. If you look at the complaint, there's a whole litany of claims in there challenging everything related to this. So they could have approached this differently. Those claims didn't need to be asserted in this case. They chose to do that. And again, I think just from the standpoint of the practical implications of we could allege 50 claims just to make sure we can delay the litigation process, because that would delay the finality of the challenge to the public improvement or the bond issue in the case, because we couldn't get to the finish line. We'd have to
agree, though, counsel, we would be reversing our own precedent. Or if not, what language would you recommend we use to suggest it's not in opposition to our earlier decision?
I think, Your Honor, I would, again, just rely on the language of the statute in based on the specific facts of this case, and that where a party brings multiple actions challenging. And again, these are intertwined. It's, the open meeting law and data practice are related to this project, where they bring multiple actions related to the bonding or project, that those are encompassed in the action and are subject to dismissal if a party does not post the bond in a reasonable amount of time.
But isn't that just going to encourage piecemeal litigation? Because then, I mean, if I was the plaintiff, I would bring just the claims with regard to the bonding, and then if a surety bond gets issued that I can't pay, then I would, and that claim has to get dismissed with prejudice, then I would bring my violations of the Data Practices Act and the open meeting law, which is not subject to the surety bond. And so, I mean, I guess I'm just, I'm not understanding why that would be the intent of the legislature, that in order, if there are multiple different harms relating to the same set of facts, why we would be requiring plaintiffs to sort of piecemeal litigate those claims.
Your Honor, I just, with the limited time, I would say again, I'm going to rely on the plain language of the statute and just the importance of this project, and ask that this court affirm the district court.
Thank you, counsel. Were there other questions?
Thank you. This is John again for Appellant Larry Cook. Just want to touch on a few things. First, the property itself, there were no plans for the property in the watershed district watershed plan.
But, I mean, you don't disagree that this property was, I mean, who's the owner of the property under the allegations in the complaint?
The creek runs up against private owners. It doesn't belong to the, I don't know their names off the top of my head. But
I mean, these are individual landowners, and there's nothing preventing them from selling the property to someone else. Does the complaint allege that there's...
It is their burden to show harm to the public. If they are going to say that we could lose this hypothetically, they could have gotten an affidavit or anything. The reality is this is not going to sell. And it's because there's going to be permits, and they've already approved permits to develop this twice before this. The developer didn't develop it. They left. Now anyone who comes in knows that this land is being earmarked for whether it's the Watershed District or the DNR or someone else. This is not land that's going to sell. And that's on them to show that there
will be multi-million-dollar individual who just wants to have a nice piece of property by the creek.
And in that case, the important thing is they still have their permitting power. And so nothing's going to happen to this land outside of what their mandate is. If someone comes in and wants to, you know, put up a high-rise, they can say, no, you can't do that. If someone comes in and says, oh, I just want to hold it and preserve it, they can still say, we're doing creek preservation along this area, and they can come in and still do that. That is the tool they're supposed to do this kind of thing. And the underlying action challenges, what are you even doing?
Counsel, has there been a Liz Pendens filed on the real estate?
There is not. And there is, based on their testimony that the ongoing litigation stifled any financing, we didn't do that. Then they came up with this contract for deed, which is a whole different, they took it a whole different direction. So there was no harm. There was no harm. The only harm that can calculate is interest. We have case law saying interest is not appropriate because it's so speculative. At the end of the day, we might end up saving them, let's say they prevail, in 2 years and they refinance, we might end up saving them hundreds of thousands of dollars as compared to what their original financing is. We don't know. It's too speculative. That's why it's not the basis for damage. If they would have done nothing, they would be in a better position. But they charged forward with this, and so that, what is the message? Charge forward, cause harm, so you can get your surety bond and move on with things. And what is the surety bond in this case done? It's prolonged litigation, and that gets me to the final point I want to make in 2 minutes. We never got to the merits of this case, which we believe is required in issuing and determining an amount. Under statute, the court must look at if there are statutory or constitutional issues, and assess the merits and the likelihood of success. They never did that.
We do have some cases from our court. They are non-precedential, but that have said if you don't argue to the district court that there are substantial issues in the case, that is an issue that can be forfeited. Why is that? Why shouldn't we follow that?
The court.
Non-precedential. Why is that non-binding?
First of all, it is the court that is required to do that, right? The direction is to the court to, when you do your analysis, to assess if there are constitutional or statutory issues. Our complaint and all of our arguments below were about the statutory issues, and I list them in my reply brief.
But why wasn't it your burden to explain to the district court that these were substantial issues as opposed to just issues? That's what our case law in the like Walker Properties, the Woodbury case, said was, if simply having a statutory issue isn't enough, you have to say, district court, this is a substantial statutory issue upon which you need to analyze the likelihood of success. And that failing to make that argument to the district court forfeited the issue before us. And I'm wondering why we shouldn't follow that as...
Well, part of one small distinction here is part of this argument got caught up in the wash of the TRO and the surety bond being side by side, and a lot of that being about the merits of the likelihood of success. And we thoroughly analyzed in that analysis and in our dismissal that there are statutory issues that need to be addressed in this case. And so if the court is directed by statute, this isn't like Dahlberg where it's case law where you have to do it or else it gets remanded. This is the statute saying you have to do it, and they commit one sentence. And the backdrop of this, and I have 4 seconds, is that they could have issued a ruling on the motion to dismiss in 90 days. We kicked it out. We canceled hearings. We got more briefs. We kicked it out. That is a sign of an abuse of discretion where the surety bond wasn't used for its intended purposes, and it stifled a just resolution. So for those reasons, we ask for remand. We need to have a full analysis and a hearing on these issues, and we hope that you do that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your argument today. This case has been submitted, and we will issue a decision within the time prescribed by statute.